Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Let's move into this, because I hinted before I want to use the word public shaming a minute ago. You talked about coding or coded language and things like that. When you interviewed me, there was a section where you simply say, but you, of course you would admit that Joseph Smith was deceptive or something there. As I listen to podcasts of yours, I don't listen to every single one of them or something like that. You know, terms like racist or sexist or, you know, again, fraudulent, deceptive, these things seem to be pretty freely, said by you or your guests without your trying to say, now slow down here. that's a loaded term. That's a, so I just want to have a discussion with you about terms like that. Using it's got a fraudulent foundation and things like that. When you know that there's nuance there, and yet you don't take the time to to add the nuance. In other words, where is the benefit of the doubt of even if somebody is racist, that they also there's compassion that could be had for that person,
right.
Or something like that.
I hope I've never argued against compassion for the brethren, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, the GAs. I feel like overall I've tried to really communicate empathy for the difficulty of their position. But let's just take the word fraud, because let's just start by getting on the same page. So I'll just – this is not going to be revelatory. I'll just say it really plainly. For me, as I look at the Book of Abraham and the Papyri example, or the Book of Mormon and the what I would see as co-opting biblical text and, teachings and stories from Joseph's surrounding culture. For me, there's no chance that there's any ancient origins to these books. And B, the overwhelming evidence is that they're created by Joseph Smith or whoever was around him at the time, that there were no gold plates delivered by an angel, that there's really no chance that happened, that the Book of Mormon is an ancient record, that a Nephi and whoever really existed, and that the papyri were what Joseph claimed they were. And so for me, what that means is that at some level, if Emma's hefting plates, then Joseph had to have created them and made her think they were golden plates given by an angel, when in reality they weren't. They were forged by Joseph or somebody else, and he was allowing her to believe something that clearly wasn't true. With Abraham, Joseph didn't, the Book of Mormon claims that when they talk about how it was translated, that the characters actually appeared through the seer stone.
No, Joseph never said that.
Okay, well, people say that Joseph said that, or
no, that's just John Whitmer. Listen, we did a 3-hour seer stone podcast, and certainly he never claimed that. He never claimed anything beyond the gift and power of God as how it came about. And so when you talk fraud, to me it means I am a perpetrator of fraud on purpose, and you in some ways without then allowing that, some sort of sense of if you were in his shoes and you felt a, a commandment or a directive by God or something like that, can you have an imagination where you may make some human mistakes along the way that might involve shortcuts or something like that? In other words, I guess I'm just, there's so much starkness to some of the terms that, you know, you throw around and that you let get thrown around here without like stopping the discussion and saying, oh, so by that, do you really mean, like when we get back to the, what do the brethren know? Do you really think like Corbin Volus put something out on Rational Faith recently, you know, where this conspiracy to hide everything and stuff like that. I would want to always query that kind of language.
Let's jump back to the word fraud for a second. I am very certain that Joseph knew that he did not receive golden plates from an angel, and that he knew that the book he was producing was not an ancient record, but instead was sort of stories and myths and borrowed sort of remix from his cultural surroundings. Similarly,
he was at no time in his life he was in some kind of spiritual state or some kind of state that felt extraordinary to him in some ways.
No.
This is not normal. Normal thinking.
Okay.
At some point, I feel a flow or these ideas coming to me, and they feel fundamentally different.
Okay. If he had said, I was in a dream state, and this text came to me, and I'm going to write it down because it's from God, that's one thing. But what he said was, an angel came to me and gave me these gold plates, and then I translated them into this text. And to me, that on its face is fraudulent. And similarly, when he says, I got this papyri, and I know how to translate Egyptian, and so I'm going to translate this papyri into English, I think he knew that he could not translate
Well,
Egyptian?
He ultimately gave up on that, but then it's at that point he kind of went into the same sort of, to me, state of production that he used with the Book of Mormon for that. So, obviously those attempts to read Egyptian and to say this character matches up with that, he gave that up, and it's at that point that he produced the Book of Abraham.
And all I'm saying is I think...
And so that flow state for him feels to him like it's God involved.
I'm not arguing against him believing that somehow God was inspiring what he was doing. What I'm saying is, at its very core, he deceived people about the golden plates, having received them and having translated them, and he deceived people about having translated the papyri into English. He knew he was not translating either text, and he allowed people to believe that. And in my belief, that is direct fraud. That's just, you know, if I did that today, if I uncovered this text and said, oh, it's Swazi language that nobody can read, and here, I've produced an English version, and here it's saying all these things. If I were to do that today, Dan Peterson and, you know, every apologist alive, plus every believer, plus every ex-Mormon would all call me a fraud. Or if I were to create plates and say, these plates are from God, but you can't look at them, but heft them, and they're golden, and they've got characters on them of this language that no one's ever heard of, and I'm going to translate them into English because it's God's word. Every person alive, except for someone I was able to deceive, would say, John, you're being a charlatan right now. But because we've enshrouded Joseph, in my view, with all this holiness and goodness and legend and Babe in the Big Blue Ox and Paul Bunyan, and then it's all sacred and we can't call a spade, which is that Joseph deceived people at very fundamental levels. And when he went and told parents that their daughters should, you know, in my view, sleep with him and marry him, that's that God said so, and that an angel, I don't think Joseph really believed that an angel came with a flaming sword and commanded him to sleep with 15, 16, 17 year olds. I think he had a strong libido and was caught up in things and deceived people. And so I don't think that the record allows for us to give Joseph the benefit of the doubt. For me, the record shows that Joseph frauded or deceived people, also with finances, also with other types of things. Although that doesn't mean that he didn't believe that in some ways God was inspiring him. I'm sure that that's possible. We all think that God or good, you know, I remember making a decision that was clearly evil where I felt like somehow God was very happy with it because it felt really good to me at the time. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I allow for him in his sort of misguided emotional rapture to feel like somehow deceiving people was still okay in God's eyes, especially because the scriptures he believed in allowed for God supporting deception and even murder of people. So that's one of the dark sides of scripture, is they can actually endorse murder or deception because that's what the text actually says. So yes, I can see that Joseph could have believed that God was inspiring him to deceive people in some ways, and that he had good intentions and in many ways wanted to help people. But to me, at the very basic level, he was deceiving people in very basic, undeniable ways.
Yeah. Okay. And I get that. And, you know, I would only probably nuance that, you know, in a few places. I tend to just, the reason for my asking the question is that you recognize that kind of language without at each point that you use it saying and sharing other possibilities that have been advanced. You know, like pretty much everything you said there, you know, there's people who've wrestled with that and who've you know, presented an alternative. But you make these claims and things like this. So I'm back into this where we started the whole thing. You are, you know, a public figure. You're saying, I support all of these pathways, Mormon in Mormon or something like that. But when you go so strongly with this kind of language here, what's behind it? What is sort of driving you, or what are you revealing about yourself here? So what is the relationship for you for Joseph Smith being a fraud and Mormonism being possibly a great tradition that somebody could truly, you know, have a rich, powerful, very happy, super expansive, you know, go all the way to stage six kind of life? So, you know, how do you balance the poison, you know, the fruit of the poison tree or the fraudulent tree with everything else that you're trying to claim? Because to me, you would need to constantly, you know, not use such declarative language.
Okay. So I completely acknowledge that I'm using very, you know, taboo language, right? I am
loaded, yeah.
Desecrating language, right? Loaded. And it took me a long time to be able to use those words, right? I think part of the reason why Mormon Stories survived is because I avoided using those words. I think some of the reason why I was excommunicated is because I started using some of those words.
Right.
So at its very base level, number one, I use those words like fraud and racist and sexist because to me they're the most accurate way to describe what I've observed based on my understanding of the evidence, honestly. And so, you know, you mention, because I do, I think Joseph committed fraud. I do. And I think Brigham Young, you know, saying that if you, you know, have sex with a black person, should be killed. Like I do think that's racist. Now, I can follow that up and say he's a product of his time and that if I had lived in the 1800s, I might have felt that way too. But there were also lots of smart, enlightened people who didn't have those views back in that time as well. And so we can't just say that everybody had those types of views in the 1850s and 60s. I don't think that would be accurate. So, you know, I'm happy to give an asterisk when I use those words. But well, I
but do you give an asterisk? You don't. That's what I'm trying to say. I think you're using them. Your comfort in using them is belying something.
Okay, let me explain why. I'll explain why. A couple reasons. I believe that truth matters, and I know that truth is a loaded word, right?
Yeah, I actually have a set of questions on truth for you.
So it's and this is going to be a little bit repetitive, but I'll just make it really quickly. To the young gay Mormon who's committing suicide, you know, whether or not the church really is what it claims to be, whether or not the prophet really speaks for God in his life, that really matters. To the woman who's thinking about deserting her husband and taking the kids because he's lost his faith, whether or not the church is really true actually really matters, because maybe she wouldn't break up her marriage if she realized that what she's been led to think is true really isn't, and that her husband deserves respect and not abandonment. And the most concrete example I can give is my former, you know, BYU roommate as a freshman, Monty McCotter. We were, you know, good friends growing up in high school. We were freshmen together at BYU. Monty McCotter goes on his mission to, you know, Puerto Rico or the Dominican Republic, and he gets hit by a car and killed on his mission. And for Monty, if the church really is what it claims to be, then that's a sacrifice worth making. But if the church isn't what it claims to be, then he gave his life for something that was actually a misrepresentation. So in my view,
well, then that's the same thing for every soldier.
Sure.
Going
sure.
to an unjust war.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of people don't, you know, sign up for the military. They get money, monetary benefits. They get scholarships for school. They realize there's a chance that they're going to die. They don't really perceive America as necessarily claiming that it's God's one true country. It's just like, well, this is my country and I want to defend my country. But it's a very different, for me, it's a very different proposition. Allegiance to a country than someone claiming to actually speak for the one almighty God. And when somebody takes it to that level, I am God's spokesman. I have a privileged access to God. And what I say is what God believes and thinks. To me, that's like the most serious thing you can do to someone who tends to believe in God. And so my goal isn't to say destroy Mormonism. I'm not that type of ex-Mormon. My goal isn't to try and even tear people's faith down. If I could wave a magic wand, what I would want is every single Mormon alive to have a full understanding of the church's history and its you know, historical record, good and bad, and a full understanding of the harm that the church can do to people, as well as the good. And then to be able to make a fully informed decision about whether they want to remain members based on having all the information. Now, of course, I don't have all the history. I don't know all the good and bad the church does. So what I aspire to with this magic wand is impossible. but with Mormon Stories and with everything that I've done, it's not been to tear the church down. It's not been to erode faith. It's been to awaken people to the point where they can go, oh, Joseph did that. Joseph did this. Brigham said that. Brigham said this. The Book of Mormon claims to be this, but the evidence is that. Women get hurt. Feminists, you know, minorities get hurt. LGBT people get hurt. This is really serious. Okay, I'm aware of all that. Now I'm going to make a fully informed, conscious choice. And once they then say, I want to remain, then I'm cool with it, right?
Yeah.
But until they have had the chance to make a fully conscious decision, because you know that the missionary program preys on vulnerable people, people that aren't as educated, the people that are in a low SES socioeconomic status.
They prey on them, John? Come on.
Well, they target vulnerable people. They do. Missionaries
vulnerable in order to get their money? What's the vulnerability? They always try to. I always hear they want to go after leadership material folks.
Well, that is the ideal. But if you look at the lived missionary experience, you go to the poorest, the most uneducated, the most quote humble, and those are the ones that you target because that's where the numbers come from. And you know
because numbers numbers is the goal versus they would sense that those are the ones that seem most likely to be open to receive the message.
For thousands of mission presidents and for tens to hundreds of thousands of missionaries, numbers were often the goal.
Yeah. Sure, but they wouldn't ever say that in a public meeting.
No, but in the lived experience, it was, what are your numbers this week?
Right.
Get your numbers up. What's your goal? Have you hit your goal? You haven't hit your goal. You're punished.
And every one of those guys would be embarrassed by that if it were laid out like that. And so I'm just saying, why don't you lay that out instead of using language like preying on those? In other words, it's like there's some like Stanley Whiplash, twisting his mustache here.
I'll say, if you look at the body of Mormon, so I created Mormon Stories. I encourage you to create Mormon Matters. I created A Thoughtful Faith and have supported that. Stay LDS. Those are all projects that originated with me that to this day I financially bankroll and support, right? Okay. With time, with money, with effort, sure. Right? If you look at that overwhelming body of evidence, that all points back to me. So I'm supporting you in what you're doing. I'm supporting Gina Colvin. I'm supporting Stay LDS. And if you look at my body of work, even with Mormon Stories, I've supported conversations on both sides of the issue. And so I'm very comfortable with the balance of the overall portfolio of what I've sponsored and originated and created. I don't know of anyone who's been more balanced than that overall portfolio. Dialogue's been pretty good. Sunstone at times has been really good. But as far as podcasts go, find me a podcast that's more balanced than
right.
Than,
but would than, you say, than, but are you still being balanced in your podcast, or do you have to go to the body of work in order to say, here's the balance of John DeLynn?
There is absolutely a difference between my own personal journey, and that's the blessing and the curse of Mormon Stories. In the one sense, the curse of Mormon Stories is it was my journey all along in many ways. I interviewed people that interested me. I interviewed people because I had questions, because I was fascinated. And what drove, how did I get 560 episodes over 10 years with all the pain and suffering? It's because it was a personal passion for me. It wasn't some academic journalistic exercise. For me, it was very serious. It was very personal. And I just did my best to be neutral. So in some sense, that a lot of people benefited from that and enjoyed it. But then once I reached some conclusions that were not always favorable to everybody, that's when the curse came for many, because then I moved directions and it became about me. And in many ways that tainted the Mormon Stories body of work. And part of me is split about that. Part of me wishes that it never happened. On the other side, there's a lot of people that say, I listen to Mormon Stories because your journey interests me. And that's been part of the fun. It's been not only to hear all the different people you've interviewed, but to experience your journey along the way. And I wish I could have been all things to all people and have done it perfectly. But so I acknowledge that my personal rhetoric, because of my personal experiences, has bled over into Mormon Stories in the past few years and over the past 10 years. When I was Stay LDS and really faithful, well, guess what, Dan? I was going the other direction, right? And I was calling out ex-Mormons and calling out post-Mormons as anti-Mormons and using speech that made disaffected Mormons feel belittled. And, that bias ran both ways back when I was asking mm-hmm. you to start Mormon Matters and championing A Thoughtful Faith and Stay LDS. And so, yeah, for better or for worse, my bumpy, exhausting, narcissistic journey has infected Mormon Stories in every direction. And in some ways, that's awful, and I'm sad by it.
No, how could it not be? Yeah.
No, but in other ways, that's what people have liked about it. And in the end, it is what it is. And so, yes, when we're talking about balance, I can't stand on where I am today because I'm not balanced, but I can step back and look at the portfolio and say, show me another podcast or body of podcasts that's as balanced. It's not Infants on Thrones, not Mormon Expression,
Yeah, for sure.
So
you're going to win that one for sure, John. So I guess the question for me has to do with more, you have made these conclusions And so now you're comfortable with the language that is pretty strong. How is it that what is it that you use to judge good history from bad history, to make the conclusion that Joseph Smith did this for this reason versus that for another reason? Because I know that a lot of people, you know, as they look at some of the podcasts you'll do, you'll have certain guests on that are basically not well-respected historians or well-respected people, and just because you have this enthusiastic personality and you use the word super and great and you're a hero and various, you know, kind of things, and that's endearing to me about you. But it's also, I'm not positive, where is your sense of how to judge the sources? Do you go to primary sources yourself, or are you relying only on secondary sources? You know, how is it you distinguish a Richard Bushman from a Grant Palmer in terms of, you know, why does Richard Bushman not think that the different things that Grant Palmer was sharing in Insider's View, why does he not feel like those are seriously compelling pieces?
So I don't know if I need to defend the caliber of historians I've had come on Mormon Stories.
Because this is Mormon Stories. This is their journey and things.
No. What I'm saying is Michael Quinn, Richard Bushman, Claudia Bushman, Brent Metcalf.
They're great. I mean, I'm just saying that
tons of great historians.
But now that you've made these decisions, that again, this is still tied to the declarative, loaded language stuff for me.
Okay.
You've Joseph Smith approached women or these families. I want to sleep with your daughter. You know, you basically make that's the case versus a Richard Bushman. You know, who at least will want to frame that in terms of, I want to unite our families. I want us to have a kinship relationship or something like that. You say the one thing versus the other. Who are you reading versus not reading that, you know, kind of gives you that sense of empowerment to,
okay. So
to
I
speak on the one side?
I believe that even recently in interviews, I've said that I believe that partially Joseph was motivated by this expansive desire to unite everybody. So I actually am okay with that being a layer of complexity for Joseph. All right.
Okay.
So, but when it comes down to it, I mean, okay. So who have I read?
How do you evaluate who you read? Unless you control the material yourself, you know, do you have a skeptical mind when it comes to something being in print?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm certainly not a historian. I'm certainly not, even in the, 90th percentile of most knowledgeable regarding historical things in the church. I'm a hack in many ways when it comes to history. But, you know, I've read Von Brody, I've read Richard Bushman, I've read Claudia Bushman, I've read Michael Quinn, I've read Grant Palmer, I've read, Matt Bowman, I've read Terrell Givens, I've read, you know, just most of the big names in Mormon history. I've read them, and I've gone enough to the primary sources to feel satisfied. But at the end of the day, I don't think any of us, you know, when Richard Bushman wrote Rough Stone Rolling, it was maddening to me because you can sort of come from a faithful perspective and paint a context where when you start describing things, somebody would go, oh, well, that totally makes sense. That's totally reasonable. And people can read Rough Stone Rolling and go, what's the problem here? Joseph's awesome. You know, these are not the droids you're looking for. Pass right on, you know?
Nice.
And I do not read Richard Bushman as a balanced, fair contextualizer. I view him as an extremely biased, his devotion to Mormonism and fidelity to the church, while he's a top-rate historian, completely biases how he contextualizes the evidence. And so when he says something like, oh, well, perhaps Joseph was experimenting with peepstones and folk magic as a way for him to develop and to harness his you know, spiritual chops so that once he does have the chance to translate the plates, he's been able to practice with these other artifacts. Like, to me, that is...
Dude, do you want to keep that voice in this podcast? I can let you go back because I don't know that that's going to serve you well.
No, I don't. I respect Richard Bushman, and I say that just as a, I say that with the sense of humor that in my family people talk like that for fun. I don't mean to demean Richard Bushman, right? But I'm just saying that.
So you believe that Richard Bushman and somebody who comes to the opposite conclusions about the same material, it would be Richard's loyalty to the church that drives him saying this, and somebody else that does it.
Sure. So I believe when I look at the historical evidence, I'm a fan of primary sources. I've dug into them enough to feel satisfied. I don't think anybody has a photograph of what happened. I think we all put together a mosaic, and we base on primary sources, secondary sources, culture, feelings, experience, biases. We're all painting a mosaic of what we think happened, right? And you know, if you go too close, nobody's painting is flawless. But you know, I believe that you can gather enough information to be able to step back and have a pretty decent sense for what happened. And I just personally, I really respect scientific peer review, and I really respect, you know, what I'll call Occam's razor. And for me, you know, for just the perfect example is going back to this question of fraud or not. I think that it is obvious to anyone who's objective and not overly biased by either fame that they get from their affiliation with the church or tender relationships with other believing and devout Mormons or reputation positive reputation that they get from their affiliation with the church or their emotional connections to the church. If somebody's able to divorce themselves satisfactorily from those very heavy influences, or anyone who just was never raised Mormon and has no devout sort of affiliation or connection with the church, they look at Joseph Smith's Book of Mormon, Book of Abraham, polygamy, and the story is really, really simple. It's that the Book of Mormon is not what it claims to be. The Book of Abraham is not what it claims to be. And Joseph got carried away with his libido and power and took advantage of people. And I don't think there's any other reasonable conclusion that isn't tainted by, again, reputation, emotion, family connections, social connections, monetary connections. I think that's pretty clear. And that,
so
you know,
only the only clear-eyed people are the ones that use the type of language that you do. The only ones who really are seeing
clear. No. I'm not saying either of those things. I'm not saying that I'm clear-eyed, and I'm not saying that everyone who's clear-eyed uses the type of language. What I'm saying is that for me, it's an open and shut case at face value that Joseph Smith committed fraud with the golden plates and his account of the Book of Mormon and how he produced it. It's an open and shut case that the Book of Abraham is a fraud in the sense of it being, advanced as a translation of Egyptian. And it's at face value egregious that Joseph Smith took 30 to 40 wives, lied about it, and engaged in sexual intercourse with underage women and lied to Emma and everybody else. To me, there's nothing divine. There's nothing nuancy about that. There's nothing that can be any attempt to sort of feel okay about those things is informed by a strong social sort of, social conditioning or a strong desire to avoid taboo or to remain in the faith or to remain respectful. And that's what I've concluded. I know that that comes across as offensive or hurtful, but in this case, I think it's this fear of speaking plainly, of crossing that taboo language, that really does us a disservice. because sometimes I think apologetics or nuance actually takes us away from just simply saying that was wrong. And it was just wrong. And deceiving people about the plates is just wrong. And claiming to translate Egyptian when you can't is just wrong. And claiming that you speak for God when you don't is just wrong. And manipulating your influences and relationships such that you can sleep with underage women and other people's wives and sending people on missions so you can sleep or marry their wife, that's just wrong. And any attempt to use flowery language or philosophy to sort of soften that as anything other than just wrong, to me, leads people to feel like they can be empowered to do all sorts of bad things because the spirit told them to, or they felt some type of emotion to justify their behavior, you know? And I feel bad using such plain language, but that's what being plugged into all the damage that the church can cause led me to feel like I needed to speak plainly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's understandable when you play it only in the fields that you're doing. What was missing until like less than a minute ago was the first time you mentioned, I don't care what the Spirit is saying and things like that. And there was never anything in any of your explanations up until this point where you even acknowledge that there are, that Joseph Smith really... Well, I guess you occasionally you would say maybe he felt inspired to do this or something, or he really thought he would do it and stuff like that. But when you don't analyze or use, I don't know. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, I know the fluidity in which spiritual truth comes to me, and I tend to grant that same thing to Joseph Smith. And I tend to believe that you can be completely wrong in, nine areas, and yet, something powerful and important is still, you still have an important channel, and you still have very good things that can kind of, emerge. Like, for instance, when I look at the church leaders and they're so wrong or they're so behind or something like that, I tend to look at them and go, okay, look, at these guys are doing good in the world. They're working hard every day for something they feel is valuable for. They probably don't notice that the Spirit is withdrawn from them in the area where they're, they're not in what I sense is in tune. And the same thing with Joseph Smith or something like that. I tend to think, other than the time when he, lost the 106 or the 116 pages were gone, and he finally, he's lost the ability to plug into the channel that is sort of his frequency with God. And if you listen to the Joseph Smith Seer Stone podcast we did, you can kind of get some more of my sense on that. That's the only time that I think for Joseph Smith that he felt like, okay, something's fundamentally changed here. I've got to get right with God. I think at every other point of his life, he could just go to that channel and he could plug into that channel and he could have things start appearing to his mind, and they're inspirational things, they're big things, they're good things, even though he could be completely wrong in these other things. I still think that he had this sort of connection with what he thought is the divine. So even when you say he's purporting to translate Egyptian and we know it's not from those papyrus, I still think Joseph Smith, when he finally gave up on trying to do the one-to-one correspondence and he went in with Seer Stone or whatever means he was to produce the Book of Abraham, he could still very genuinely believe that, the interpretations of the facsimiles he gave and the words there are actually what are on the scroll or what are on the papyrus, and he wouldn't be committing fraud at that point for me. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I mean, I understand that perspective. I would just say, why, if it's anybody else in the world who reviews the evidence, right?
Okay.
Any non-Mormon who reviews that evidence says, oh, charlatan. right?
But part of the evidence is the text and the text's own feel and the text's own, you know, your own experience with the text where, again, maybe you granted it some sort of priority, but yet it did open up spiritual vistas to you that have given you expansive views that have worked in your heart in a way that makes you a bigger, better, larger, happier person.
Right.
You can't dismiss that.
No.
You can't dismiss the production, what was produced from the means.
Here's for me, and this may be a tiny bit repetitive, but I'll try and say it in a different way. It's one thing for Tolkien to say, I was inspired to write Lord of the Rings, right?
Sure.
He says, he doesn't claim it's history. He doesn't claim to be translating anything. He's just saying, hey, I was inspired, and it's fiction. But
he knows he's working on it in some sort of constructing way versus
sure.
what seems to be with Joseph Smith, flow state.
Well, I'm just saying that for me, Joseph crosses the line when he tries to deceive people that he really received plates when he didn't. And when he tries to claim to be God's primary mouthpiece on the earth, you know, when he probably wasn't.
But he might have thought he was, then, legitimately. Is that a deception when you actually
he knew he was practicing polygamy and lying about it.
But
he knew that.
We started to get into that when you were talking with me, but, you know. Again, where's the slack that you cut somebody who, if you were to grant the idea that they might have felt wrong or right, they might have felt called by God, and yet the reality of human relationships, the reality of the times and the mores of the times and things like that, could anybody really go about it in a completely, transparent way?
Dan, no. I'm just saying that if you know, you have a daughter, right? And if somebody came to your daughter as your future son-in-law and said, hey, I found this papyri and I've translated it into English from an unknown language. And hey, you know, Dan's daughter, will you marry me? And by the way, I'm going to take 29 other wives and some of them are going to be 14 and I'm going to sleep with them and then I'm going to lie about it. There's no world where you would extend that same level of empathy and understanding and nuance and philosophical approach. You would say to your daughter, get the hell away from this sociopath. And that's just a fact, Dan, I think. And if I tried to do any of those things that Joseph did, I think I would be put in jail, killed, run out on a rail, and any of us would. And the only difference that I can see is that we were all raised to hold as sacred this story. And because we so desperately love our emotional experiences at church, in the community, when we read the texts, in our interactions with others, because those give us such positive emotions, which I don't, deny, then what we do is we say, oh my gosh, the cost for bailing is so high and the positive feelings that I get are so incredible that I'm going to go to the great lengths to say, make all sorts of crazy justifications that I would never allow to someone today in this real world. But I'm going to afford it to Joseph because he lived 180 years ago or whatever, and because it's sacred and because I've been taught it's sacred and I don't want to get kicked out of my community and I love going to church and it feels so good. And the only thing I would say is that there's all sorts of things in life that feel really good. When Jeffrey Dahmer ate people's brains, I know he felt good about that, you know? Like, I know that there are lots of people who have been parts of, let's just, I won't violate, is it Godwin's law? What is it? Gödel's, when you invoke, Hitler or Nazi, what's the thing you should never do? Like, I won't explicitly do that, but I'm sure that you could take any fascist regime over the past 10,000 years, any imperialistic state, any crime, mob scene or gang-related sort of activities, or cults, or people who believe in UFOs. and or Jim Jones, the people that are willing to kill themselves, or the dudes that flew into the Twin Towers, all those people are going to say, oh, but I felt so good reading that holy book. And I felt so good at that religious service. And I felt so good being a part of marching with my fellow soldiers and the camaraderie and the friendships that we built. I don't think positive fruits in and of themselves are a solid foundation for justifying what I believe should be just face value, egregious, unacceptable behavior. And I'll extend that to say that when we condition people to not call evil evil and to not always call good good, then we sort of can get what you might see with the FLDS Church or with the Lafferty Brothers, where people are like, wow, well, I read Laban and Nephi chopping off his head, and Nephi got a good feeling that he should do this. What's, you know, I'll kick my gay child out of the home because I got this good feeling at General Conference. Yeah, and I just think there's danger in saying I had a positive experience, I feel positive emotions, therefore it must be from God, and therefore I must follow. And when Joseph claims to be God's single, entitled, unique, exclusive mouthpiece on the face of the earth, he crosses a very important line that makes it even more serious for me.
Even if he genuinely thought it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't doubt on some level he felt really positive emotions towards these girls, towards their family members, towards the desire for Zion and bringing everyone together. I don't doubt that he was worried about the fate of Alvin, his brother, and how are we all going to get back together someday. I think that he believed that the words that he produced in the Book of Abraham and the Book of Mormon would be inspiring to people, and that maybe even he felt like God was working through him. But there's enough for me clear, obvious fraud and deception in all those stories that it's important for, and the stakes are so high at all the people now that are giving their time and their money and their lives to these propositions. There's enough at stake, and the stakes are high enough that for me it's important that we use clear language. And that's where I feel like sometimes apologetics can move into the area of sort of giving cover for abusive and bad behavior. And that's when people have accused me of this in the past, when you start to say it's okay and, you know, it's nuanced and it's symbolic and it's the fruits are so good and how did you feel? Sometimes the end result of that is giving more money, more time, more power to the people who are inflicting real harm on other people or deceiving people. And I think that's an important perspective, as is your perspective of saying, look at all the good. Don't give it away too quickly. There's nuance here and there's context, and we should understand more deeply. I will explicitly validate your approach. And my dream would be that you could go, yeah, I see your point of view too.
Oh, I definitely see your point of view. Yeah. At some point, I think I'm more interested in what's behind it rather than, you know, the flow of words that you just gave or something like that, because there tends to me to be a feeling of, well, if I say this strong enough and I don't offer the expanded, but of course it might be this as well at the same time. It feels like I am directing you towards a particular answer, and it's my answer. And you know, you asked me that several times. Well, don't you think somehow you come across like you think yours is the better way, right? And so are you owning that you think that yours is the more clear-eyed vision than those who you know, for whatever the calculus is, whether it's a mental calculus like you, but you know, for me it's super infused with spiritual experiences, you know. That I don't think you ever still always give, you know, you talk about emotion and you'll talk about pressures and you'll talk about desires and feeling good and camaraderie and all those kinds of things. But somehow or other for me, you know, the ear for the moments in which, you know, all that stuff is clearly not what's going on, you know. I don't know. So I guess, I didn't intend for us to go an hour on this, but I do sense that there's a point in which you have passed beyond in the current thing. Again, the balance of your work is balanced, you know, with all the different things that you've created. But I think you've passed the point where you can tell it fair or tell it in both ways. And so really I was asking, you know, why is it that you feel these sources or these ways of viewing it? I just wanted to see, you know, how is it that you're putting yourself in a position where you might be wrong now? How is it that who are you reading? Who are you? Are you still on a journey for the truth? Or in this case, these, you know, you use the word open and shut case.
Okay. For me, like I don't run around questioning gravity, because I just feel pretty convinced that it's a pretty solid theory that really governs, you know, our mortal existence. I don't question anymore, even though I'm taking it on faith. I've talked to enough scientists and watched enough TV and have enough faith in science to sort of say, yeah, I'm pretty sure the Earth revolves around the sun, and I'm pretty confident with that. And I see that pretty clear eyed now. I believe that I've never really seen germs, but I really believe in germ theory just because of what I've experienced and what I've read.
You can see germs.
What? Yeah. And for me, the non-historical nature of the Book of Mormon, the non-historical nature of the Book of Abraham, the cover up of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, the polygamy with Joseph Smith, you know, the church's approach to homosexuals. These are things that are as obvious to me as that Tolkien is fiction, and that gravity governs our scientific world. And I do not think that a reasonable, objective person who reviews the evidence will come to any other conclusion than what I just said.
But yeah, you're not talking about spiritual evidence.
Okay, so let me get to that. Let me move to that. Yeah. So I just want to be clear that I am clear-eyed, and I think it's that open and shut. I think it's Earth revolves around the sun. Book of Mormon and Book of Abraham are not historical ancient records at all, and Joseph Smith's polygamy is evil. Now, when it comes to spiritual and emotional and feeling sorts of things, I think that a ton of good comes from the church, and I think that these things can lead to enlightenment and expansiveness and inspiration and good fruits. And I'm on a journey seeking truth and wisdom and expansiveness and growth and healing. And I 100% validate people who feel like their journey within the church also leads to that, you know, 100%. 100%.
I didn't know if you're done.
I completely validate. I don't think I have all the truth and wisdom in the world. I don't think I have all the enlightenment, and I validate both paths. You know, I don't know if that answers your question. Do you want to ask a follow up?
Well, I guess, you know, again, I have 5 pages of notes here, and this was back from page 1, and we're, you know, 2.5 hours in or something like that. You know, and to let you know, I have had amazing spiritual dives that came out of, you know, this close reading that I have given to the Tao Te Ching. You know, I don't read it in Chinese, but I've read enough translations, and it's on my bedside, and 2 to 3 times a year I study it. You know, it's part of my meditation sometimes in my, you know, my trying to protect myself in the morning and you know, have some time where spiritual things are... to me, whether or not Joseph Smith is a prophet or anything like that, the stakes aren't that high for me. You know, I have to say, because it's my autobiography, that sometimes, you know, pondering something in, you know, Messiah 4 or, you know, Alma 34 or, you know, Section 93 or Section 88 or something like that. When I'm in these modes, that's been catalyst for me to go far beyond those texts and into things that completely couldn't care less about what put me into this, you know, noetic realm, this realm of where I'm feeling like something is happening to me that I'm not driving. This doesn't come from within me, that I'm somehow like a floor has opened and I'm now, you know, getting fed from new rivers, or, you know, something else is bubbling up for me. So I'm not claiming that it's that big a question for me whether or not Mormonism is true. I've shared, I think, enough times that, you know, my view of ordinances and things like that, there's no salvation at stake for me in Mormonism or not. Yeah. So I just wanted to be clear with all those kinds of things. But what I don't think is fair is for us, again, I maybe it's not fair, John, because I don't know your own experience. You talked about, you know, that time when you're feeling the spirit from a state conference, and you said something like you were walking on air. You felt like you were surrounded by light for weeks on end.
Yeah.
That to me is a fundamentally different experience than pretty much any adjective or anything that you have shared here before. In other words, and I don't think that there's this clear distinction when we feel those spirits between truth and good. You know, if something is true or something's good, I think the similarities are pretty big there, because I don't think very many truth claims or discursive language or cognitive ways of phrasing something survive when you're in these bigger experiences. So you somehow, you know, through a Mormon means, somehow or other, you know, something started flowing with you, and it from that point on, for the next few weeks, and that's a pretty typical thing, everything felt light. Everybody felt divine. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I can't quite remember what you said, but you fundamentally had a shift there. So with those kinds of things in mind, to use the narrowness of the language and the cut and dryness of the language and things like that, for me, it says something. It just says something like, I don't really think that Joseph Smith's production, because you always worry about how it was produced rather than what he produced, you know, you know the service project in which the person next to you has been your enemy in Elderscorm, and they now become a being of light. So these productions and things like that, despite to me, with the narrowness and the strongness of the language, and without adding the nuance at each time, so it just feels unfair.
Okay, and so I'll try and make a really quick answer. So, and this will be a tiny bit repetitive, but also hopefully number one. Everyone who's black who's ever baptized into this church, I think, has the right to know that the church discriminated against blacks for 150 years. Now, other people may disagree with me on that. I think so. Really important that they know that before they join. Similarly, you know, if I could wave my magic wand, everybody would listen to the missionary discussions and read, you know, Jeremy Runnels' letter to CES director or Mormon Think, and have a really clear understanding of the origins of the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham. I think that.
And see, again, those would be sources that to me.
Okay.
You know,
so make them.
They're important.
So allow.
They're important for our culture, but they're not, you know, bullet point history.
Okay. But for
bullet
me,
point context for, is never going to be
no,
enough.
No. I'm not. I was using those as an example. I wish that someone reputable would come. You know, the church's essays are a step in the right direction, but I wish that, like, Adam Bowman or, you know, whoever, right? Pick someone that we could both, you know, that both non-believers and believers respect. I wish that they would come up with an alternative to Mormon Think. And I wish that a panel could, right? Because obviously Jeremy doesn't believe anymore, and he's not credible now for believers, and Mormon Think isn't credible, but also neither is fair, right? So, Get whatever right. committee you want to together, put out something that's more neutral and fair. But my point is, get that information to every investigator, because right now what happens is they're being taught the narrative that is not – they're being taught the narrative that's deceptive. They're joining the church saying, oh, you know, an angel delivered gold plates to Joseph, and then Joseph translated them with the Urim and Thummim. And that produced the Book of Mormon. And that's
so you're ignoring the fact that they might be having genuinely spiritual experiences.
Wait,
that
wait,
say,
I'm getting there. I'm getting there. Okay. I'm saying that I think when there's evidence that is historically credible, that speaks to the origins and the authenticity of something, or evidence like with blacks and discrimination that just, or gays or whatever, like just the notion of full disclosure, I think is important for me. That's number one. Number two is that it's not, if everybody were just reading the Book of Mormon in isolation and having spiritual experiences, none of this would matter. But what happens is kids are born into the church. They're taught from age two to say, I know the church is true. They're taught that that Monson speaks for God. They're taught that their bishop is God's representative for them. And so it's not just these isolated, positive, emotional experiences that I had, that you have had, that others have had. It's the fact that those are tied to an institution that brings vulnerable people. And I will say vulnerable, whether it's investigators that are ignorant to many of these things or young children that are brought up in it. And then get, you know, the young kid who masturbates and then is shamed again, or the gay person or whatever, they then get confronted with really difficult, sometimes toxic and even life-ending situations because the book and the spiritual experience is tied so tightly to, you know, before you're able to become Dan Witherspoon when you're 40 with a PhD and throw nuance at everything, you may have tried reparative therapy and committed suicide. You may have entered into a marriage where you then don't believe anymore and your wife is taking the kids away. You may have, you know, instead of pursuing a PhD as a female, you may have married some guy and had five kids, and now the future that you really would have chosen wasn't really made available to you. And for me, it's the connections with the institution that make full disclosure and the stakes of difficulty much more significant. But then if you can give full disclosure and blunt the negative impact of the institution, then yes. Then at that point, for me, it's all about what good comes from your reading of the text. How does it enlighten you? How does it expand you? But for me, I can't turn a blind eye to those other things in this narcissistic rapture of that wonderful emotional experience I had as a teen. To me...
So again, it is just an emotional experience.
Well, maybe it's spiritual.
Just like others.
It's spiritual, Dan.
It didn't feel different.
Don't miss my bigger point, because maybe it was God speaking to me, right?
Well, again, that's goodness.
But I'm saying I'm not going to sit and marinate in the rapture of my spiritual, you know, thrill if it comes at the expense of all these other things. To me, they're all tied together. That's just how I am, right?
Other people's experiences to your wanting to do that, is what you're saying.
Everybody needs full disclosure. To me, in my view, every black person should know about the church's discrimination against the blacks. Everyone who hears the Joseph Smith narrative should know about the First Vision accounts. Everyone who reads the Book of Mormon should be taught about its historical problems. Everyone who learns about the Book of Abraham should know that it's not a translation, and then be allowed to make a decision with the full evidence.
Sure. And I agree with that it should all be available and willing to do it. On the other hand, I don't know that in a situation where somebody is seeking God, they're seeking a change, they're seeking somehow to step up into life in a richer way, and it happens to be the Mormon missionaries or their Mormon neighbor or something like that that comes along and says, there's hope for you. There's you are not just the sum of your choices to this point or something like that. You know, if you want, my church has helped me along these paths away. And if somebody like feels drawn towards Mormonism or something like that, I don't feel like that person needs the full load of, you know, basically it would take you a few weeks or months to go through this very rational, let's weigh it out, full disclosure kind of course that you're talking about here. I'm quite comfortable with somebody's spirit saying, I'm reaching out. This was an energy source that called me towards it, and I'm stepping into a bigger and a better life right here. As long as all those resources are there, and I think the church is recognizing that they need to be there. And I think, again, this broader expanded view of the church that, you know, pretty much most of the people of the world can get on the internet and things like that. I just don't know that it needs to be quite as systematic and full on ahead of baptism for everybody.
Well, it's never going to be, you know. Most of the missionary work now being performed is in the third world, where people don't have access to these resources in their language. So it's sort of a...
And they wouldn't join if they had?
I don't know. Saying? I'm just saying we're sort of arguing a philosophical, theoretical point that in reality is not super important. So we're talking magical realm, wave a magic wand kind of thing. But for me, it's like, you know, even if I really enjoyed the leather upholstery and the air conditioner felt really good and the ride was really smooth, you know, if some of the pistons were broken and the engine had been run without oil and it was 10,000 miles away from blowing up, I think everyone should know that. Even if you feel really good with the air conditioner and the upholstery and the radio sounds really good, full disclosure, when people are aware that there are significant problems, I believe full disclosure is crucial. That's just how I...
Because you also believe that they wouldn't join. You really do believe that.
No.
Because it's so cut and dried in it.
I know.
It's so clean.
Listen to me, Dan. I have people write me all the time and say, Mormon stories caused me to join the church. I do not believe that full disclosure means people don't join. I know that there are gay people who remain celibate and miserable in some cases, knowing all the history for the rest of their lives. Like, religion is extremely powerful and compelling and resilient. And I believe that reasonable people can just make different claims or hold different beliefs or maintain allegiance. I just think it's the moral, ethical thing to do for people to have all the information before they make a decision that has such significant consequences for them and that could really blow up for them later on. I think Jehovah's Witness, they require a year of investigation before you can join. So yeah, if I could wave a magic wand, people wouldn't get baptized till they were 21 or 18, and they'd be given all the spiritual, positive, uplifting things, but also all the difficult things, and they could have all the information and then make a really educated decision. And investigators would not get baptized in a week or 2 weeks, like often happens in the mission field. They would get months and months of lessons and information and experiences. And if the church was as compelling, you know, in 6 months, all the better, you know, but just don't withhold the information and then blunt the impact of the institution, create some type of, you know, inoculation or immunization so that when they join, they're not set up for the disillusionment of when the prophets get it wrong and when the bishops get it wrong and when things go wrong, you know, they're not just like totally plugged in to the matrix to the point where they get railroaded into self-harm, which I think does happen. You know, it really does.
Yeah. Some language in there that's a little bit strong and overstated, but I agree with you to the most part. Do you have any warm feeling towards the fact that pretty much what you're calling for in many ways is the trending direction?
Of course, but
for the church, in other words, and an organization has a lot, you know, before it can turn.
Of course.
And
but again, the fact that the church claims to be led by God, but really what happened is the internet happened and shamed and embarrassed and forced the church into making these changes, you know, makes it the stakes very high, and it makes it less, you know, a little bit less benevolent or magnanimous of the church's changes. And then, of course, the fact that I feel like I and many others were important factors in the church actually making these changes, whether it's Kate Kelly in the female changes or me and many, you know, tens of thousands of others before me about the historical candor, and yet they punish and excommunicate people like me as a thank you for moving them in the direction they should have gone. Obviously, that sours my benevolence a little bit. You know, if somebody makes a decision because a gun's being held to their head, it's very different than if they look around like the Community of Christ did, sort of like, hey, let's do the moral and ethical thing, even if it's going to hurt us. But that's not what our church did. What our church did is it punished and stalled and punted for as long as it could until it literally couldn't hold out anymore. It hurt as many people as it could trying to delay. And even as it made the changes, it threw under the bus many of the people who were instrumental in helping those changes come about. And to me, that's not gracious. You know, it's not cool, you know? So yeah, I acknowledge the progress and I don't have a ton of respect for how they've handled it in many ways.
Yeah. And I would fill in a certain learning curve on their behalfs and, you know, desire and need for unanimity on action. And I just tend to know that the sausage is not made in a clean way. And when you overemphasize, well, they claim to be led by God, you know, there's lots of complexities to how somebody is led by God that isn't just, you know, quite as clean as you want to say there. And I know
then that, I wish they would openly acknowledge that and make it a common understanding.
Right. I do too.
That they also made tons of mistakes and viewed through a glass darkly, right. And that they lived.
Of course, we've had a couple of moves towards that direction.
I wish that they would live the humility that is incumbent upon people who really aren't any more special than anybody else. But instead, they perpetuate.
And some try that and some do it.
Well, right. I think overall, in General Conference, they perpetuate the leader worship, stand when the prophet enters the room, don't question authority, and whenever you step up and criticize or question, you are struck down in this church to this day. And so...
But you agree that lots of general authorities would say these are
privately
as well.
Privately.
But they right, but and you don't know exactly what's happening behind the scenes towards ending this.
No, but
we have basically a complex structure full of people with different experiences and different abilities to see these things, and whether or not, you know, a lot of it is going to be determined like what friends and loved ones, you know, have run into the different things that you're claiming here, as to whether they're alerted to it, and then are they on the right, you know, committee to where they could speak up and actually get something to move up the ladder. There's just so much going on in the church that I think sometimes you're, you know, if it claims to be led by God, you know, therefore it should be able to clearly see this right this second when I see it, you know. You know, I think that happens one person at a time, you know, slowly but surely it does happen.
Yeah, I agree that change is complicated and sophisticated and difficult and complex and nuanced and takes patience and time. I totally agree with that.
Yeah. And ultimately where I'm, you know, all of this kind of stuff for me is, again, you know, I stand up for it when I can, when it comes up, when it's clearly right in front of a place, when it could be a constructive moment, I want to say those kinds of things. At certain points, again, I don't know how to say it enough, John, that spiritual independence, that working through a stage four kind of thing of moving from all the things that you've inherited into, you know, a careful weighing of these things to where you are, you know, you have a very long and deliberate, reasoned, you know, place for your stance. It's then that all this stuff can be met, and it can be met without despair, without as much despair, certainly sadness and loneliness, but not as in despairing. And again, to me, somehow not as so starkly condemning that, you know, it seems to me where you've shifted to, you know, it just, and again, this is going back to the language of, you know, fraud and deceit and that, you know, it so easily flows from your mouth. So, we've beat this dead horse, but respond back if you want.
I honestly don't feel like I'm, comprehensively condemning. I really, if I were, I would shut down Mormon Matters. I would shut down Stale DS. I'd shut down A Thoughtful Faith. And I would tell everybody that I meet with to run from the church. But I don't. When I counsel people, I ask them what their values are, and I validate staying for anyone who feels like staying is what's right for them. I continue being overtly and covertly supportive of people who feel like staying is right for them. And I just think that I really believe strongly in things like transparency and candor and speaking out against wrong and abuse. And I just feel like I need to help push both sides along, really. You know, that's, I don't know what else to say.
No, I hear you. And again, you know, going to the larger body is one thing. And again, all this kind of started for me with there were certain questions, and we kind of circulated, you know, anything you want me to ask John. And it was just this, you know, John, you recognize that you're a powerful and influential person. At some point, Mormon Stories, you know, like you say, it's always your journey and things like that. And your talk with your interview with Gina was certainly wonderful and transparent and stuff like that. But now you're doing Mormon Transitions, and you've embraced this public role, and yet at the same time you are being very clear about what your things are. Can you be truly an effective therapist if you had a mixed marriage, you know, couple in this sort of situation? Can you do all the things that you say you want to do, or have you in some ways decided my ministry now is going to be more towards those that are either moving into post-Mormonism or just this amorphous thing called progressive Mormonism?
Yeah. So there's definitely been a shift with Mormon Stories. For example, I have no interest in interviewing, you know, an apologist about how they believe anymore. And that's because I kind of have – it's not interesting to me anymore, because I feel like I've reviewed enough of the evidence to, right, to draw my conclusions. And so – you're doing enough of a good job about helping people stay in the church. I'm not interested in sort of covering that territory anymore. So there are things that used to be super important to me that I just have no interest in. I'm also – honestly, I have zero interest in reading Mormon history right now. Like – you couldn't pay me to read a book. You would have to pay me a lot of money to read a book, a Mormon history book these days. I'm just not interested. So as far as, you know, I think I've shifted though. Like, I don't think you'll see me posting on Facebook, the church is a fraud and Joseph Smith's a fraud and the church, you know, run away. I think I'm moving away from any, I don't think I did that very much. And I think I'm really moving away from that. So I've lost interest in talking about the truth claims at all.
Would you stop people on your forums from saying that? Or would you like to ever throw a caution?
I just don't have time to moderate. I mean, I've got 7,000 people in that Facebook group. But
your dream would be that nobody does these quick hit, you know, extreme rhetoric condemnations.
Yeah. My dream would be that people go, hey, you know what? My review of the evidence leads me to believe this isn't true. And other people are like, hey, you know, my review of the evidence says that it is, and let's just love and respect each other. I wish that everybody had that level of respect in their discourse. That would, you know how much that would thrill me? I'd probably pay $30,000 a year to be able to have that be the level of discourse on anything associated with me. Because yeah, I hate people who are disrespectful on either side of the equation, really.
That's nice.
Yeah, for sure. But 7,000 people in the Facebook group is just unwieldy. As awesome as our moderators are, that's just impossible. You know, I've got almost 10,000 followers on my public Facebook page now, and I just don't have time to moderate all the comments. I wish I did. So that I regret. That I think is one of the most unfortunate things about everything. Not, you know, I've made mistakes. But what's, I think, been most damaging to Mormon Stories, me, my brand, is the fact that so many of my commenters are so negative and strident and disrespectful that it oftentimes gives me or what I've tried to do much more of a bad name than it otherwise would have. You know what I mean? And that's true about comments on Mormon Stories blog. That's true about Facebook comments, etc. And then the only other two things I'll say is I feel like I am shifting towards what's interesting to me, even though all those other things don't interest me. I am super interested in helping people through their transition. For those who have decided that the Orthodox correlated TBM kind of view isn't going to work for them anymore, I want to help minimize the pain and maximize the unproductive pain, I'll say. Minimize the unproductive pain and nice. Maximize the healing and growth. And if that goes into staying in the church, honestly, I wouldn't be supporting you and Mormon in a thoughtful faith if I wasn't okay with that destination. I am okay with that destination. But I also want to, you know, as I look out there, there aren't a lot of people who are trying to say, hey, let's focus on healing and growth for post-Mormons. You know, there's some, but it's not obvious where the real centers are for very constructive, practical sort of support for healing and growth. And so, yeah, I'm willing to spend the next 20 or 30 years of my life supporting that, not because it's just a Mormon problem, but because, as you know, the fastest growing religious group in the U.S., and it's over 20% at this point, are people who are no longer affiliated with any religious tradition. And I think they deserve as much healing and growth and enlightenment as religious people do. Now, the final thing I just have to say, because it's my career, is that I feel, and I think you could ask my clients to date, I have 6 years and over 1,000 hours of clinical time. I am 100% validating and supportive of people who want to be TBMs in the church, people who want to be in TBM marriages, people who want to be in a mixed orientation marriage, a mixed faith marriage, people who want to leave, people who want to go back and forth. You know, I have deep respect for the psychology code of ethics that really mandates neutrality. I've been trained for 6 years by non-Mormon psychologists to doggedly respect the values of my clients. I think that all my non-Mormon trainees do an amazing job at this at Utah State University and elsewhere. I think that I have done this, and I think I'm committed to this. And I think you'll find that certainly the vast majority, if not all of the people that I've been a therapist for, will tell you, man, I was surprised at how affirming you were of my belief. I was surprised at how supportive you were of our mixed faith.
That's great. And
to do anything other than that is to ultimately get your license taken away and barred as a therapist, because the code of ethics for psychologists is so clear that religion is to be respected, people's paths are to be respected and affirmed, that religion is to be respected and affirmed. And I'll just end by saying that it is completely ineffective to try and tell people to leave the church or stay in the church or to believe or to not believe. As soon as you do that, a client says, you're an ass. I don't want you as my therapist. I'm not here to have you tell me to believe or not believe, to stay or leave my wife, to masturbate or not masturbate. You know, clients just don't stand for that. They come to you because they want support in figuring things out, but no client wants you to tell them how to believe and what relationship to have with their spouse or with the church or with their sexuality. And if a client comes to me and says, I'm gay and I want to marry a woman, I'm like, okay, well, let's talk about what's hard about that, but let's also talk about what's good and how do I support you, you know? Or maybe I'll refer them to somebody else, but there's no way that I'm going to try and impose my beliefs or push people one direction or another.
Yeah, no, that's great. I knew that about you and I sense that about you. I guess the question, I think it was originally formulated as in, now that you're so more public about, you know, the direction of your own life, do you worry about that in your client relationship? Meaning, you know, they know they're coming to you with this there. And so this, the fact that you're a public person, do you feel, you said in your interview with Gina, you only wanted to probably have a few clients at most and spend, you know, 30 or 40 hours of your week, you know, doing this larger transitions thing versus clinical stuff. But is that part of the factor, the fact that you, you know, the people who would be attracted to you, you know so much about
you? Yeah, it completely, it completely bums me, you know, and this was just really one of the hardest parts about being a therapist at, you know, at Utah State University, because I would have these students come in and either they'd smile when they saw me in the greeting room for the first time, or when I brought them into the office and I'd tell them my name, they would stop me and say, well, oh, you're the John DeLynn, you know, or they grin and say, you know, I listen to your podcast. I hate that. Like, if you think that when somebody comes to me and says, I'm here to have you be my therapist and I've listened to 500 hours of Mormon stories, that's not like something that I smile and grin about.
Right.
That's a nightmare to me, because I honestly, I don't think I do. I'm not a therapist that thinks that I can tell people the way they should live. I have tons of humility about being broken, flawed, confused about life. Like, I don't emerge as a therapist thinking I know what people should do in their lives. And so I don't want them looking at me as a celebrity, and then whatever I say, they hang on to, like they should look at me like a prophet. Nothing makes me more uncomfortable. So yes, for all the people that I see as a therapist, my dream would be that they would not know me and know nothing about me, and it's all about their journey. On the other hand, I feel like my conscience impels me to speak up, and so I can't shut that off. And then also, sometimes my experience ends up being useful to people, and because they know about me and what I've done, it allows them to get help that they otherwise would have sort of suffered in silence about. So I'm torn about it, right? But it's certainly not like, yay, it's awesome, I'm famous, and I'm going to help the world. It's more like, this is messy, and I wish it was less messy, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you, Guy. We've spent 3 hours. Crazy.
And you're on page one still.
Well, there are quite a few things, and I'm still debating them and stuff like that. You know, I really wanted to have a nice discussion about, you know, all the different ways that something can be true, and to kind of hear your feelings about, you know, the importance of truth that, you know, may never have happened. You know, the whole idea of, I'm about to tell you a story, it never happened, nevertheless, it's true.
Oh.
You know, and I'd love to hear you, you know, again, because you're now, it seems like you're proactively moving into like healing and growth and things like that. It's going to be most likely that you're not going to use a lot of Mormon talk. You're probably not going to use a lot of God talk, a lot of spirit talk or something like that. So I want to kind of hear a little bit about, what does truth mean to you in the sense of ideas that might not be attached to, you know, factual.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I'll try and give really quick answers, because I know you're sensitive about time. I wrote down your three sort of theories on truth: correspondence, coherence, and pragmatic. And I want you to know, I value them all. And so I can just start out by saying 100%. You know, John Steinbeck is one of the most inspirational figures in my life, and everything that he wrote is fictional, and it's completely true. You know what I mean? Like, I think fiction can be true because it relates sometimes the true lived life experience better than obviously a biography or an autobiography, totally. Right? Like, of totally. Course, you've heard the quote that the highest form of fiction is autobiography. And, you know, because someone's writing about themselves, and man, how biased is that, right? So,
and
fraudulent and deceptive and whatever. So,
gotta throw those words in there, brother. Yeah. Fraudulent and deceptive.
For someone's autobiography, like, for someone who claims that they have.
So nobody can write autobiography that isn't fraudulent and deceptive.
Right.
As well, again, there's going to be some element of that, but just, never mind. This is what we've been arguing about for an hour.
Well,
and a half.
At least you can see that I'm turning that back on secularism, right? I'm not using those terms purely in a religious context.
Yeah, but they to me, they just send you in the wrong direction.
I understand.
Go ahead.
But
I'm just use all the postmodernism and all that.
Yeah,
kind of
well,
stuff
to get to the
same point.
I'm a blue collar.
There's no innocent text.
I'm a blue collar.
We know that there's no innocent text.
I mean, I've got like 12. I'm on Google Scholar with like 12 publications. So, I'm comfortable calling myself a scholar, but I'm a blue collar scholar. You know, I'm not Christine Haglund. I'm not Adam Bowman. You know what I mean? I'm a meat and potatoes bologna sandwich kind of scholar.
There's Adam Miller and Matthew Bowman. So, but they're both good guys.
Oh,
so,
sorry. What did I say?
Yeah, you said it before. Adam Bowman.
Okay, Matt Bowman and Adam Miller.
Bowman
okay,
and Adam Miller. Yeah, that's.
But but I'll just say that I love myth. I love symbolism. I love fiction. I love inspiring works. I find value in all the religious texts and in secular texts too. That's never going to change. And I have already made the point that I do think that evidence and truth claims matter because of full disclosure and of the stakes of people's literalistic beliefs. I've already made that point. But I would just push back a tiny bit and just say that if a client comes to me and they're a true believing Mormon, I am absolutely going to invoke my knowledge of scripture and of what they believe to help inform how I interact with them psychologically. And if somebody is a progressive Mormon, I'm going to invoke parables of Jesus or of church history or of Book of Mormon stuff to the extent that I think it's not going to cause them to be allergic and offended. Right. And so I am not in any way averse to you to not only valuing the spiritual and symbolic and metaphorical and spiritual sort of values of text and of religion and religious tradition, but I'm going to use it based on where I perceive the client is and what's going to be most useful to them. And that's going to be true in all my work with Mormon Transitions too. So.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to see what happens with you with that, brother, because, there isn't, we're still in this point where we do need to develop a language, you know, for that, that maybe doesn't necessarily always need to be God, that doesn't need to be spirit, that doesn't need to be soul, and all those kinds of things. And so have you found some that you really like, that you think hold promise for, you know, speaking to those things that just really aren't part of your normal brain chatter, that they really aren't, you know, using the cognitive filters, but somehow or other there's some profundity for your life?
Yeah, I'm still okay. So personally, I still think of myself as a spiritual person. I still value spirituality. I still consider myself a believer, just in kind of the same way you do. Like, I think our beliefs about, you know, the truth claims are all probably almost identical. I think that our perspectives on some type of value and meaning and energy or force in the universe, maybe you're a little bit more into that than me, but I think that we share much more than we differ. So that's just me personally.
No,
when I'm in front of a crowd of atheists and agnostics and post-Mormons that are heavy, then when I use those terms, I feel like I need to sort of, okay, when I say spirituality, I mean this. And when I talk about God, I mean that. Right. And when I validate all paths and, you know, I feel like I need to sort of define the terms in a way to where they're sensitive to the fact that that language is triggering to other people. Right. and complex and nuanced. And yeah, I may speak more secular to a secular audience. But then again, that's just driven by wanting to use the language that connects with people and meet them where they are. And I feel like I'm able to separate my own sense of meaning or energy or spirituality from the people that I'm trying to help, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't identify.
So you don't know yet. Do you know yet what Mormon Transitions will be? Will it just avoid the trigger language, or just go trigger warnings all the time? Or I was just curious if, you know, I know you've looked into Sunday Assembly. You've probably looked at Alain de Botton, School of Life kinds of this. Is that going to be more the model that you're going to, rather than just like, okay, I know that this means something to you that I don't necessarily mean, but I'm trying to get at XYZ, this part of the human experience?
Well, I think you raise a good point that the more we can improve the language, the better. You know, one of the things I explicitly don't want to do is have some sort of doctrine or theology or, you know, sacred text that's like claiming to be divine, you know what I mean? And I don't,
of course not.
While I respect Alain de Botton and Sunday Assembly and Oasis and all that Community of Christ. And, you know, I kind of just want to use language. I want to find a way to speak to people where they are, you know what I mean? And, I don't shy from using the term spiritual again, as long as I define it. I don't like having to give trigger warnings all the time. I think that sometimes treats people more fragile than they really are, and just makes conversations really complicated when they don't need to be. I do think that you can talk about morals and values and ethics without having to tie it to, God or spirit.
Divine command theory,
I think you can talk about, a lot of it's going to be just how to communicate with your loved ones, how to communicate with extended family, how to build community, how to be moral, how to raise your kids. And there's all 98% of that conversation doesn't need to invoke terms like God or spirit. But I consider spirituality or its alternative in a secular world to be one of the pillars of Mormon transitions. It's one of the major holes in the soul that develops. And if you think that I think that somebody just, loses their faith in Mormonism and all of a sudden they don't need a connection to something bigger or a sense of spirituality or of enlightenment, you're totally wrong on that front. I don't think you do think that, but
I acknowledge
spirituality or its secular alternative as a fundamental pillar of human wholeness and well-being. And whether it's nature or deep connections with other people or meditation or mindfulness or prayer or just, private spirituality or even worship in a different church that connects with you better, I see all that as being a part of something essential to the human experience. And it's going to be inextricably linked as a pillar of what we do going forward. My wife and I, every morning, we meditate for 10 minutes. Yeah. Every single morning, 6 out of 7 days.
Right, yeah.
We sit down and we meditate. And Margie would tell you that's a spiritual, even though she doesn't know if she believes in a God or a spirit or sort of metaphysical whatever, to her, that's a spiritual exercise. And every Sunday, our family goes on a hike to one of the canyons in Logan. And we consider that a spiritual connect with nature, connect with ourselves, dig for something deeper.
Nice.
That's all still very much a part of who I am and what I hope to encourage,
Well, good, brother. I'm more power to you. There's definitely an audience for that and a big need for it. And I'm glad to see you stepping into it.
And I appreciate you encouraging me to not forget that stuff and to pay attention to it. You've been an important influence in my life.
Yeah. We keep reminding each other how we come across or what's missing from our particular rhetorics and stuff. So I'm grateful for that too. And it's been fun. So I don't know if anybody's ever listened this long to two guys talk as what we were probably close to 3 hours when you interviewed me.
Yeah. Yeah. Between Lindsay and Gina.
This would be ridiculous. Yeah. It's going to be 10, 12 hours, right?
Nobody.
Holy crap.
I swear I will buy a steak dinner to whoever, listens to the Lindsay thing, the Gina thing, the me interviewing you thing, the you interviewing me thing. If anybody makes it through all of that, if they come to Logan and our schedules align, I will buy them a steak dinner.
Nice. Thank you, brother. It's always fun to talk with you. I always, you've been an important person in my life. What's the whole line of, friends sharpen friends the way, steel sharpens steel. And, I'm glad that we were always able to talk and yell at each other, yet know that it's good.
Totally. I love you, Brother Dan. I respect you. I honor your path and what you do. And I look forward to at least 30 or 40 more years of us going at each other.
Sounds good. We all have our calling in life, right?
Absolutely.
So our angles that I don't know. It's so interesting. Our autobiographies are inescapable.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I think was so brilliant about Mormon Stories. You really just opened us up to that space of nobody here claims that they have the truth. They're just telling their story. And in some ways, even though we've moved more into truth claims and what is truth and, what is best or worse or something like that, ultimately, in many ways, we're just telling our Mormon stories through all this as well. Stories of our lives and what shaped us.
Totally. Totally. I'm so grateful for this conversation that we're all a part of. And I think we're all better for it. So thanks, Dan. Thanks for all you do. It's inspiring.
Thank you, brother.
All right, brother. We'll talk soon.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well, all is well, all is well.